The McIlvaney Weekly Commentary, covering monetary, economic, and geopolitical news events. Now here are Kevin Orrick and David McIlvaney.
Welcome to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. I'm Kevin Orrick along with David McIlvaney. David, we're coming in after a long weekend. Now, you're coming in a little worse for the wear, I must say.
Well, thanks, Kevin. Do I look that bad? Now, you know, we went to the desert. My sons wanted to spend some time in the desert, and so we did. Moab, Utah, beautiful place. But gale force winds this weekend, 60 to 70 mile an hour winds, and somewhat unexpectedly, our tent collapsed. Bent poles piercing the outside of the tent. Calamity at midnight. It was a fantastic trial for all the family to move into sort of emergency mode and deal with it. And
you know,
deal with it we did.
Those things can be bonding experiences. But, David, as you left on Friday, I told you that there were winds that were forecast to be 70 miles an hour. I said goodbye. And
yep.
You said, oh, yeah, we're going to Moab, you know. So I guess what I'm asking you is this. Okay. When something is forecast to be really bad, and it is bad, okay.
And we were prepared for it, actually. I pride myself in having equipment that is able to take that kind of a gale force wind. You know, whether it's climbing Rainier in the middle of winter or whatever, I'm not going to go unprepared.
Right. You have good, best equipment.
The problem is sometimes the preparation that you bring to the table is inadequate given variables that are outside of your control.
Well, then I'm wondering if that doesn't transition us into the weekend in Europe, because we keep hearing about these tens of billions turning into hundreds of billions. It's a problem, but how big a problem is it, and are we prepared for what comes afterwards?
Well, it's a huge problem, and I think to look at the scale of things, whether it's Greece, whether it's Spain, you know, what we had in Ireland and the bailout packages put together now a year and a half, 2 years ago, this is in real time a crisis that's unfolding in front of us. I think the important point to make is that tens of billions or hundreds of billions, while a large problem, pales in significance to our domestic issues, which are in the tens and hundreds of trillions, if you can wrap your mind around that.
If you wrap your mind around derivatives. Now, of course, this is more of an American phenomenon than a worldwide phenomenon. So give the Europeans their hundreds of billions, but we Americans, we can take our trillions.
And hundreds of trillions. So, yeah, the equity markets in Greece over this holiday weekend and Friday were signaling a commitment by Greece to stay in the euro. Every Greek official that was given a turn at the microphone seemed to have the power to swing shares very significantly. And, you know, certainly fear is priced in. Bankruptcy is in the back of people's mind, but hope has not been fully purged. And what we saw was traders stepping into the financials and the Greek banks. Shares earlier this week were up 10-15% in a single day, which, frankly, is not all that impressive when you're talking about a 25-cent stock soaring to 28 cents.
Right.
Or something like a 5-cent increase on a 50-cent stock. I mean, as recently as 2008, there was one particular Greek institution, a bank, which traded at over $25 a share and is now 50 cents. That's a $14.5 billion market capitalization, which is now roughly $300 million. $300 million is still a lot, but relative to its former size, yeah, as we mentioned on Friday's written commentary, the Greek banking system has benefited thus far from $100 billion European Central Bank liquidity infusion, which was secretly approved. And yet, you're still seeing banks that traded for, again, double-digit numbers, now traded a fraction of that, literally pennies.
Well, and when you see these traders coming in, Dave, it's interesting. You talked about a 10 to 15% swing, you know, in, well, is Greece going to stay in the euro, or are they going to exit the euro? These 10 to 15% swings can be very painful. We saw that, you know, last week with Facebook. Sure enough, we had a 10 to 15% swing. It was an initial trader move. Maybe some of those traders got out and got their profits, but the public was left holding the bag. So it's obvious, Dave, no one really knows the future, not the Facebook buyer or the Greek buyer at this point.
Well, I tell you, I would call it flop book at this point, although time may exonerate the public offering that was not. The greatest public offering of our era apparently went over not so hot.
Well, let me ask you another bargain, okay? Greece is one thing. Spain is a much larger issue. You know, I was looking at the Spanish Spanish issue, and I was thinking, gosh, 400 years ago during the time of Queen Elizabeth, Spain was the dominant European power. And then, sure enough, a storm came up, it sunk their fleet, and it literally changed European history for the next 400 years. So,
well, there are these unpredictable events that you feel like you're well prepared for. I mean, yes, the Spanish Armada was something, a force to be reckoned with,
right,
and certainly could deal with outside factors, not on this particular occasion.
And not 70-mile-an-hour gale force winds.
And they didn't really rebound. They didn't really have a plan B. They didn't put that into motion. So you're right, Kevin, you have this displacement of power as a result of this exogenous event.
So let me ask you, okay, Bankia, I can either buy a pack of gum or I can buy a share of Bankia.
Right.
What should I be doing?
Well, Bankia is the third largest lender in Spain. We've talked about this in the last few months. And what happened is a year ago, they took a number of small regional banks and they put them together into one bank. And it was essentially a forced merger or forced marriage that you had bad balance sheet after bad balance sheet after bad balance sheet. Loans that had been made that were very, very shoddy in nature. And lo and behold, they just thought that if you brought all of those loans under one roof, it'd be easier to manage, and perhaps that would be their form of bailout.
So it's like having a bunch of small boats with holes in them, pull them all together, maybe they'll float.
Well, that's what they're finding is buoyancy deficiency. Bankia can't keep its head above water. We've got Bankia shares now selling for the equivalent of a pack of Wrigley's Juicy Fruit. So we were observing this last week. The required bailout funds went from 9 billion euros to 19 billion euros, with 23 billion being whispered to fix this lender's problem. The difference between those two numbers, 9 and 19, was 2 days. Wednesday it was 9, 19 by Friday, and this is, again, Spain's third largest lender.
Which they've almost completely nationalized at this point. And why don't you explain nationalization a little bit, David, because there are different ways to nationalize. Our government comes in and just spends taxpayer money to continue to bail out, but there are times when someone comes in and says, look, we're going to take over the risk. The government will take the risk. Yes, it's a taxpayer risk, but we're going to either gain or we're going to lose. We're not going to just continue to feed it with taxpayer money.
In some instances, nationalization is quite straightforward. There's just a confiscation of the asset. It once was privately owned, and today, for no remuneration, that asset is now controlled by the state. The railroads, that's happened. Utilities, that's happened. Gas companies, that's happened. And so really there's no money exchanged. Value is lost by the shareholder.
Right.
In this instance, you had $4.5 billion put on the table by the Spanish government for a 45% stake in the bank. Now they're having to come back around and spend a lot more money. And by default, they're going to end up with the entire bank. In fairness to taxpayers, I think they should just wipe out the equity class of investors in a situation like this. Don't let the state simply save the bank out of a risk-taking investor class.
Well, and it's not quite free market, okay? When we talk about free market, the investor class either gains or loses, and the state just stays way out of the way completely, which means you let the bank fail.
And I don't mind there being a kind of nationalization, not the confiscation of assets,
right,
but where there is almost a stewardship role that's taken on. If the taxpayer is going to ultimately pay the price, then they're ultimately, they should see the
benefit. They should have the gain, sure.
They should have the benefit of a recuperated company, of a re-engineered company on the other side. And in this case, you know, they've gradually been forced into that situation. To properly nationalize and take the burden on, along with sort of the full upside of a stabilized institution at some point in the future. Kind of a subsidy to a non-performing business, if that's what you actually create, is both at the expense of the taxpayer and other industry participants that simply can't compete with a quote-unquote non-working business model that's receiving funds from the government.
Okay, but we have our too big to fails here, all right? And some people would actually say not only are they too big to fail, but they're too big to bail out. I mean, at some point, when do you stop throwing good money after bad?
In the case of Bankia, this is just one of those that is too big to fail in Spain. They said that they made last year $41 million with an M dollars, and they've gone actually back and had to revise that. No, they didn't remain in the black by $41 million. There's a $3.3 billion loss.
Wait a second. How is that possible? They went from a gain of $41 million to a loss of what?
¿Cómo se dice en español? Accounting problem. How do you say in Spanish accounting problem? $3.3 billion loss on what was supposed to be a $41 million gain, and they just happened to relook at the books again. It's a bit of an issue.
Well, you know, and one way to find out that people are sweating bullets is how much interest they demand, okay? And Germany is a good benchmark to look at everything else in Europe to see just how much the spread is between German bonds, which are seen as safe, and, you know, Spanish bonds.
Kevin, a 10-year German bond is yielding today 1.36%. That's less than a U.S. Treasury 10-year at 1.71%. If you wanted to call a bond bubble, I think you could reasonably call a bond bubble not only here but there. Frankly, the appetite for bonds is a little bit misplaced, in our opinion. As, again, you look at our fiscal issues, next to Greece's, we're in about the same boat. Next to Spain's, we're in about the same boat. It's just that they're under the spotlight today and have to answer for their books, whereas we today are not in the spotlight, not under the limelight, so to say, and no one's asking us to justify the imbalances or the misstatements on our own books.
Okay, but the difference, Dave, is 5%. I mean, you're talking about 1.36% in Germany and in Spain right now.
Nearly 6.5.
That's okay. So for the person who remembers years ago when on a treasury bill you could get safely 6.5%, and really, you knew you probably were not going to lose money. The dollar was king. This is a little different. Getting 6.5% in Spain means how many days?
Well, exactly. And what they're viewing as sort of a full-blown crisis level is at 7%, which made everyone twitchy when Italy was moving towards that level. So we're at 6.5 in Spain today. In the next few weeks, we may see yields exceed 7%. The German bond market, again, it's reflecting the liquidity concerns, just like the U.S. Treasury market does here as well. For anyone supposing that sort of the whole euro project is going to fail, consider the implied windshield risk.
Okay, now, wait a second. You're a man of many technical terms. Is this a technical term for the bug just about to hit the windshield?
Exactly. Very technical. Splat is what you would describe. Spain, Portugal, Greek. These are the bugs, if you will.
And Germany is the windshield.
And they're the windshield.
Okay.
Yeah, but if you're looking at the German yield, just like the U.S. Treasury, you're not seeing failure on the horizon. Not seeing failure tomorrow. You're seeing safety relative to these other asset classes. Ireland obviously already had its quote-unquote impact moment. But what we're getting ready to see, I think, is an impact moment for both Greece and Spain. By the way, the Greece market for 10-year treasuries is at 28.21% today. So, again, by comparison, Spain's just fine relative to Greece, but relative to other members in the euro area, with the French bonds yielding 2.5%, UK being, what, about 1.77%, you can get an idea of sort of where the risk is. The UK is in a tough fiscal position, but Spain is still priced in as a worst risk by over 100%.
Okay, now I'm going to bring this back home, Dave, because a lot of the listeners that we have are worldwide listeners. They invest in Europe, they invest in Asia. But I'll tell you what, a lion's share of people who listen to this program are sitting here in America going, all right, I keep hearing about Europe. It always looks like it's on the brink of failure. There's always some reason why it's just about to fail. It doesn't fail. And actually, how in the world does that affect me? And, you know, we have had guests on who've said that this actually is something that will culminate as a death blow, not to Europe, but to the United States, because of derivatives, because of this hundreds of billions instead being trillions here in America. Now, can you tie those two in and tell the American listener, the average educated American listener, why in the world is this European situation going to affect them, and how much will it affect the pocketbook of Wall Street?
Sure, and I think the focus on derivatives is a healthy one. First of all, the derivatives market is huge. It's complex, and by design, it's meant to divide up the risk of a given asset so that the risk can be more appropriately assumed by an investor willing to take on that risk, with generally higher rewards as well. And what that is intended to do, what that's meant to lower...
Well, it's supposed to spread that risk around.
Exactly. And by spreading the risk around, theoretically, it's reducing total systemic risk. Well, Wall Street took the notion of lower risk by better apportionment and simply multiplied the number of risky bets.
They just leveraged it.
Exactly, believing that such actions were allowable following the limited, or as we mentioned, the spreading of existing risk.
What's the primary consequence of that, though, Dave?
You do end up with greater systemic risk today than ever before. In fact, if you go back to that 1998 event where the U.S. financial market was a bug quickly approaching the windshield.
Are you talking about LTCM?
The long-term capital management and the implosion of one company run by a bunch of MIT scholars. Kevin, the bets in play and what was at risk at that time was the equivalent of 3.7 times of GDP. This was the derivatives market, domestic only, in the United States.
Which is still huge. 3.7 times all of gross domestic product for America.
Right. But the problem is today, I mean, in fact, over the last 10, 12 years or so, 14 years to be precise, the derivatives bonds market has grown to where it's now 15 times that of GDP. So, you know, this last year was the first time since LTCM that growth in the size of that market actually stalled. It had been running at about a 19% annual rate.
So what you're saying is the derivatives market has ratcheted up from 3.7 times our GDP during the LTCM problem now to 15 times. But it's not growing anymore? Is that what you're saying?
That's correct. The notional value of the world's derivative market stands at roughly $700 trillion, with U.S. commercial banks carrying about $231 trillion of domestic derivatives. When you look at U.S. commercial institutions, and they're both domestic derivatives and international, that puts you at closer to $300 trillion in notional value.
Well, David, I was just talking to my son, 21 years old. We were out mountain biking yesterday, and we were just talking about Keynes's approach to being able to get yourself out of a crisis was always to borrow more and spend more. You know, and my son fortunately understands this enough to know he's disgusted with Keynes, but I do know this. When global contraction in credit starts to occur, that's no longer GDP for America. In other words, the Keynesian system can only work as long as we can continue to borrow and spend, unless I'm missing something.
Well, that's exactly right. And that's why, you know, this notion of the death of credit is so important. We see a contraction ahead, and now we've got these multiplied bets. And in the case of J.P. Morgan, this is a classic case in point. J.P. Morgan and Goldman Sachs are the two largest institutions in the U.S. in terms of exposure to the derivatives market.
Okay.
And they have been purveyors, if you will, purveyors of these products in the name of safety, in the name of systemic stability. The problem is, as a derivative pusher, they've begun to use their own stuff. They've begun to abuse the substances that they simply were pushing before, and instead of it being a risk mitigator, they're using it as a speculative vehicle. Move to the center of the stage, will you, J.P. Morgan, and the current $2 billion, $3 billion, potentially $5 billion, as noted by the Wall Street Journal, as much as $7 billion loss for this quarter. And again, this is a derivatives transaction gone awry.
Well, David, aren't we really just talking about five banks here, though? I mean, five banks own what, 90, 95, 96% of all of this derivative exposure?
Yeah, and in terms of a percentage of risk-based capital, you've got five banks that account for 96% of all derivatives. Goldman Sachs has over 600% relative to risk-based capital. J.P. Morgan, Citigroup, Bank of America, HSBC. These are companies that are in a very interesting position. Kevin, Morgan Stanley doesn't stack up against these top five, but you can again see how askew this is. If you're looking at the total assets of the individual institution like Morgan Stanley compared to their derivative portfolio, you've got a 70 times difference.
Yeah.
70 times difference. There, again, you've gone from pushing a safe product for the purpose of mitigating risk to now speculating with these vehicles for the purpose of adding to proprietary profits, and that is a growing problem. The J.P. Morgan woes began at $2 billion, as we mentioned. Then it increased to $3 billion. Wall Street Journal 10 days ago estimated $5 billion, with the outside number again, as we mentioned, moving to $7 billion in losses.
This is almost sounding like Spain, except for it's much, much larger.
Well, you've got a master risk mitigator, and again, pusher of derivatives, who's used a little too much of their own juice, it seems. And we're confusing now a hedge with an outright speculation.
Well, sometimes it's just one guy. I mean, we're talking about some guy coming in and saying, all right, let's roll the dice big, but the dice actually add up to more assets than a lot of countries are worth.
Kevin, it's very interesting. Some of the great institutions of the last 200 years, whether it's British or American, have gone the way of the dodo bird as a result of one person.
Yeah.
We don't know that that's going to be the case this time around, but the quote-unquote London whale, which is the nickname given to the J.P. Morgan trader that's put on these derivatives trades, is in the news and was in the news long before these problems began because of the scale of the trades. No one person had ever handled the scale, the size of these trades that this person was handling. And what we suggested several weeks ago was that whether it's this one instance or one just like it, we think this could be critical in defining congressional resolve for something like the Volcker Rule, or more simply, the reinstatement of the old Glass-Steagall Act.
Well, we're not into large government intervention, but sometimes you have to have some regulation when things are out of whack.
Well, and we saw this in the 20s and 30s. We saw Glass-Steagall implemented, which was, it took away Wall Street's ability to double deal and know what all clients were holding in terms of their cards. It went even further because Wall Street was creating these cutting-edge products in the late 20s that the hoi polloi employ, we're supposed to feel privileged to own because it's what the big guys were buying and selling. And actually, it was what the big guys were selling to them as garbage paper and stuffing the accounts of these unassuming or trusting investors with. Glass-Steagall basically said, you're either a commercial entity dealing with the public and with a loan book, or an institution dealing with the syndication of debt and equity. You're an investment bank. But you can't be both, because the public safety has been compromised when you have the ability to sort of double deal.
Well, and that's the thing, Dave. I mean, what are the chances that the Volcker Rule is actually going to be allowed? Volcker's basically saying, look, if you're going to be a brokerage firm, you're going to make money from commissions on trades, but you're not going to make money on the profits of what you do with the public's finances. So, I mean, that's really what Wall Street is at this point. They're worth these hundreds of billions and have these trillions of dollars worth of exposure and these gigantic bonuses, all based on being able to get the trust of the public as if they were a bank and then turn right around and speculate it as if they were a Las Vegas gambler.
And again, this ties back to Bankia, because what we have is outsized bets being made. And if you win, you keep the profits. If you lose, the taxpayer gets the bill. If you are a too-big-to-fail institution, this is the perfect place to be. And many people have called this crony capitalism. It's not. It's crony socialism, where everyone else is cleaning up someone else's mess, and the folks in government don't have the resolve to make that stop.
Well, and when we get to the end of this next quarter, Dave, when we get to the end of June and J.P. Morgan comes out with their results.
Well, and I think that'll be remarkable. If Q2 earnings, second quarter earnings for J.P. Morgan turn out to be not that bad, it'll be because Brun Elixir's trades, that's the London whale, the bank is right now putting lipstick on the pig by selling as much as $25 billion in assets that have profits. These are older purchases of paper, higher yielding paper, booking paper profits and supplementing income for the quarter with the gains therefrom. Now, they obviously have to pay taxes on that, so it's not the full benefit, which is also one of the things that we see with their buyback program, putting that into suspension. Before we go any further, though, Kevin, it's important to remember that this was a common practice by banks in terms of selling off assets and using that as income for the quarter during the savings and loan crisis of the 1980s. And what it did is it lowered the bank's regulatory profile. There was less for regulators to swing a bat at. You know, the banks appeared to still be earning enough dough to sort of get a free pass, and the regulators didn't come down on them like a ton of bricks. You just had to prove that something was happening at the bank. Because if it's only a $2 billion whoops, then why did you just cancel a $15 billion share buyback program? I mean, how big is the whoops that we're not talking about?
Right.
And again, this is where a derivatives portfolio can go crazy. What was a $1 billion, $2 billion, $3 billion, $5 billion, $7 billion, like Bankia, is this a $4 billion problem? Is this a $9 billion problem? Is this a $19 billion problem? Is this close to a $24 billion problem? By the way, the Spanish government only has $5 billion set aside to solve the entire banking community's problems. In aggregate, now they're dealing with one institution, which will take more than a multiple of
that. Well, they're talking even up to 23 at this point. And, you know, that's just today.
Right. Well, I'm wondering if Dimon, you know, the head of J.P. Morgan, is practicing the old trader's wisdom of the first loss is the best loss. In other words, close it out quickly. If he's got a loss, close it out. We suspect that hubris or pride has colored the decision-making of some of these financial institutions and perhaps good old Jamie himself.
Well, and we were talking about derivatives before, and recall that Dimon is the same guy who described the derivatives debacle in late April as just a tempest in the teapot. I mean, he obviously didn't see it as much of a problem, but he wasn't seeing many problems, was he?
No, he wasn't, which is either an admission that he doesn't know enough about derivatives to be concerned, or he spent too much time staring into the mirror, repeating something like, mirror, mirror on the wall, who's the brightest man of them all? And again, it's an issue of pride. At some point, do these masters of the universe figure out that the bets that they've made are too much for the system
and
can walk away because they really don't have skin in the game? This comes back to the difference between a publicly traded, broadly diversified risk portfolio where somebody can own some J.P. Morgan, but they're not the only ones on the hook. There's other people that share as equity investors in both the risk and the upside, although it is limited in risk just to your investment amount. To contrast that publicly traded model, look at a company like Brown Brothers Harriman. The principals in that company have complete risk, personal risk. If they lose the company, they're still on the hook personally for anything that happens thereafter. Do they care about the bets that the company's making? Absolutely. Do they manage the portfolio of investments, of loans, of syndicated projects very conservatively? Absolutely. Do they overestimate? No. They try to underestimate and overdeliver. That's the nature of a differently constructed business. And so again, we think there is more than a tempest in the teapot on the JP Morgan balance sheet. We think there's more than a tempest in the teapot on the Morgan Stanley balance sheet. And a number of these institutions, Kevin, where we are seeing a systemic problem, something that everyone in the community, financial community, has accepted as normal, the derivatives market, as a means of diversifying and reducing risk. And in fact, no financial institution will go unhurt by what will unfold over the next couple of years. Morgan Stanley, again, it has little to announce right now, but has been rapidly wasting away. I don't know if anybody's watched, but since the end of March, shares have slid from $21 to $13. It's a 35% decline in a matter of weeks. Why? Wouldn't you like to know? And someone does. Thus, there's this quiet liquidation of shares.
Well, and David, it's amazing me as I'm sitting here listening to this program myself as we do it. I'm thinking, all we've been doing is talking about the weaknesses in paper. And paper is just something that man can create, and that he can create more. And he can create more and more and more. And while we're talking about JP Morgan, and while we're talking about Morgan Stanley and Spain, Spanish bonds, Greek bonds, talking about euro paper, which has no gold backing. We're talking about the dollar, which has no gold backing. At that same time, David, at the same time that that's occurring, we've got India and China buying over 80% of all of the newly produced gold. Now, what do they know that we don't know? This paper, it doesn't even exist.
Kevin, there's a revolution afoot. And only if you know what is happening. The revolution afoot is away from fiat currency, and it's away from paper assets in general, towards real things. And this is a revolution which is very subtle at this point, because everyone still has general acceptance and confidence in the structures of finance that are in place today. We look at the treasury market, we look at the German Bund market, and we look at this as an area where there is risk-free reward. It's our benchmark for a riskless asset. And as Jim Grant has aptly put out there, this is actually going to be seen as a reward-free risk, where there's nothing on the table, you're getting nothing for owning it. In fact, all you have is risk sitting in the U.S. Treasury market, sitting even in the German Bund market. And that's not the kind of risk which is indicated by the purchasing behaviors of those in the marketplace today. People want treasuries. People want bunds. Sure. They've driven these yields to nothing and are likely to continue to drive those yields to nothing. But again, what does India and China see? As you mentioned, Kevin, this last year, physical gold coming from mines, 83% of it went to these two places, the Indian subcontinent and China. What is changing is a shift in power. What is changing is something as epic as what you described earlier, a move away from Spain to Great Britain. Only it's not the Spanish and the Brits that we're talking about here. We're talking about the West as we know it, centered on New York and London finance, moving towards something new. It may take years for this to occur. It may take decades to occur. But we see a revolution that is going to reshape the way we operate and the way we finance things.
Well, I'll tell you, Dave, I just continue to think back to something your dad used to say every time he'd give a talk. He says, just remember the golden rule is he who owns the gold makes the rules. I think we better be aware of and cautious of who we're allowing to be the future rule maker.
Kevin, I think that when you see this quiet liquidation of shares, I mean, again, we've mentioned a few companies, but it's only fair to say, as we have in past commentaries, that this is a broad issue. It's a broad issue that the folks at Cross Currents have brought out in terms of the number of shares liquidated versus purchased. And I can't say enough about Alan Newman's Stock Market Cross Currents. It's a great magazine and something that's worth referencing from time to time. This quiet liquidation of shares by insiders, and by insiders I'm talking about CEOs, CFOs, COOs, the folks who are running the biggest companies in this country and around the world, are liquidating shares at more than 100 to 1 in terms of what they're purchasing. What do they see? What do the Chinese see? What do the Indians see? What do people see in terms of the drumbeat of war, whether it's even of an economic nature or any other nature? People see an instability growing, and what we would suggest is going back to what we called our DVD, this first segment that we released 2 weeks ago. The fuse is lit. The fuse is the European debt issues. The bomb is the U.S. Treasury market. Is that this year? Is it next year? Is it circa 2015? We don't know, but we know that the Chinese have a five-year plan, and that five-year plan includes undoing the relationship they've had to the U.S. market since 1979. This is a revolution. This is a revolution which will cost us dearly as we move towards being unable to finance our current liabilities. And in that period of time, Kevin, really the next 5 years, the potential for a collapse in the dollar and a collapse in the U.S. bond market on an overnight basis exists. How must you be allocated? This is a question we should be perhaps asking the Chinese and Indians, who perhaps know something more about this than we do.
Well, you've been listening to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. I'm Kevin Orrick, along with David McIlvaney. You can find us at McIlvaney.com. That's McIlvaney.com. Or give us a call at 800-525-9556.
This has been the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. The views expressed should not be considered to be a solicitation or a recommendation for your investment portfolio. You should consult a professional financial advisor to assess your suitability for risk and investment. Join us again next week for a new edition of the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary.